Boobies and Booze on Moncrief.
Of all the gin joints in all the world, she walks into mine.
A martini, shaken, not stirred.
I ate his liver with some fava beans and a nice Chianti.
It is time for Movies and Booze. Dean McGuinness, Fionnuala Jones and Olivia Fahey are in the studio once again. Good afternoon to you all.
Good afternoon.
So these aren't really beers we're drinking. These are like, you know, this is like orange juice with a bit of beer thrown into it, Dean. Is that what's going on here?
We have got beers with chocolate and cherry in them. So it's very expensive cherries, Charbique cherries, which are grown in Peat and Land near Brussels. They're very small cherries and they're quite expensive to grow because of the size of the cherries, and they need to be picked by hand. With the first beer, we have chocolate and cherry put into a West Flanders red ale, and that is a Duchess de Bourgogne chocolate cherry. And the second one is a collaboration between Guinness and the oldest lambic brewery in the world.
So
what they've done is they have taken a beer called Guinness Special Export. It's also been called Guinness Antwerpen in different markets.
Is that the one they sell in Africa?
That's foreign. FES is the one in Africa.
Right, okay.
This one is Belgian Stout. Guinness Antwerpen is another name that they've had for it. So it's a blend of that, Guinness Original Porter, which is a beer that they had in the market in Ireland a number of years ago. I haven't seen it in a while. And Timmermans Oud Creek, a Belgian lambic sour beer with cherries macerated in the beer. And then what they do is they take the Oud Creek and the other two beers, blend them together and give them an amount of time, and that's the
okay.
thing.
All right, well, so, you know, that'll be interesting to find out about. And now, Olivia, it's heartwarming, it's got animals in it, so Mortal Kombat 2 is a film for the whole family. I would
totally, totally. Honestly, if there was two films that ever had Olivia written all over them, I think it's the two films that we have today. The Sheep Detectives being the first one. I have been really, really looking forward to this. Imagine my surprise when I realised it was a murder mystery with sheep designed for children, so I had to readjust my expectations a little bit with that in mind, but oh my goodness, is it a good movie?
But it's got an actual murder in it.
It does,
and
yeah.
And it's a kid's film.
It is indeed. Oh. And actually, the kind of whole motif of how you deal with grief is such a core part of the film, but it's such an important message that not only kids can learn from, but also adults as well. Because at the end of the day, you don't really know how you're going to respond to grief until you actively lose someone close to you.
Mm.
And then you have to kind of like learn as you go. This is a great way of kind of teaching you why it's important to kind of feel your feelings and things like that. So
okay.
It's so multi-layered and just beautiful.
Yeah, and Mortal Kombat 2, equally multi-layered and beautiful?
Nice to look at, but definitely a Mortal Kombat movie, shall we say.
Yeah. I can't remember when the first one came out, really. The
first one didn't really have a lot of Mortal Kombat in it, whereas this one actually does.
Right.
So people are more excited for this one than they were for after receiving the first one. So the second one is definitely more kind of like akin to the games as opposed to the first installment, which I can say now you don't need to have watched.
Okay, that's good. But in the first one, were people just sitting around talking about their feelings? You read my feelings as well as broke my leg.
There was a little bit of that, yeah. To be honest. It was like the lead character was a descendant of one of the main characters of Mortal Kombat as opposed to being the characters we know from Mortal Kombat. And while, yes, he does return in the second one, we're more focusing on Johnny Cage, played by Carl Urban. And that was a very, very good choice by the filmmakers.
Yeah, okay. All right. Well, we're talking about those later on. Now, there's a couple of stories here that I suppose are kind of related in a way.
Mm.
This actor from Yellowstone is suing James Cameron for basically stealing her face.
So she is alleging, yes. So this is Corianka Kilcher. She stars in Yellowstone and people might remember her from The New World from 2005. She starred opposite Colin Farrell. It was like a live action Pocahontas, kind of. That's an oversimplified explanation. But anyway, as you said, she's suing James Cameron and the Walt Disney Company. She's alleging they've used her likeness without her consent for Avatar. She alleges that he basically extracted her facial features after seeing her in The New World and then used it to create the character of Neytiri, like the lead Avatar woman. It's been a while since I've seen the Avatars. I can't remember what they're Avatar people, whatever. The lead girl who is there. she is referring to a specific, because I was wondering, I was like, how did this come about, whatever, and like the Avatar films are obviously out for so long, and like that film came out ages ago, but she's citing this video that went up last month on YouTube where James Cameron is discussing this exhibition that he has in Paris where he's talking about the making of Avatar. I think the exhibition focuses on like technology and like specifically how he's used technology in his art and creating feature films or whatever, and in the video he says, quote, this is actually her lower face, talking about how they built Neytiri's like facial features based off of Kilcher's own face. And he talked about this story as well at the time where, which again Kilcher also cites in her suit against him, that around the around the time of Avatar, she ended up meeting him or meeting members of his team with her mother because he wanted to give her like a gift because he said she was the inspiration for the Zoe Saldana character, which is kind of crazy. So I'm just wondering, was she like waiting for him to say it? Because you kind of don't have a case there. Obviously, she's the, you know, she's alleging they met in March 2010, as she said, after this. And that's obviously a year after the first, after her film came out. And, you know, she said that when he met her, that he admired her for her activism and everything she does. And also, as she said, gave her this sketch of Neytiri to basically be like, you're the inspiration for this. I think I have the quote here, quote, your beauty was my early inspiration for Neytiri. Too bad you were shooting another movie next time. So now she's also saying in her case to be like, you know, I got this sketch. It was a personal gesture, at most a loose inspiration tied to casting and my activism. But like, she's gone on now to say, you know, like the film's gone on to make loads of money. And, you know, she is an Indigenous person as well. Like, I think that has to come into it where, you know, she's talking about like, you've profited off my likeness to create this character. It's, but like, I don't really know. I would be limited in what I know in terms of legalities and stuff as to how far or where this can go.
But I suppose it's the same as stealing somebody's voice or, you know, that you would have an. And I'd imagine Zoe Saldana's probably, when you make it look like me. Like, it was like her character.
I suppose there is also an argument that, like, will he come back and argue that no, it's actually it's entirely based off Zoe's likeness because obviously they did the morph suits or whatever they're called to, like, make them look like actual Avatar people. I don't know, but like, you have him on record. You have him on record saying that she was a direct inspiration and like never got a cut of it bar a nice picture. You know what I mean? But it's interesting. I know this. I've been seeing a cover this week on, because she's looking for compensatory and punitive damages, profits attributable to the use of her likeness, injunctive relief and corrective public disclosure. I don't know if she'll get that, but I'm seeing a cover on YouTube and I thought it was interesting. Someone brought up that in 1984, now this is totally different, but Harvey Cartoons, the owner of Casper the Friendly Ghost, sued Columbia for $50 million, alleging the Ghostbusters logo ripped off Casper.
Oh wow.
But the suit was obviously dismissed. Oh. He wanted all of Ghostbusters destroyed, basically.
Any mention of the word ghost.
Yeah, essentially.
They own it. Right now, and as I say, this second story is kind of related to this. It's bizarre, really. Like, the Golden Globes have set rules for AI, but not that you can't use it.
Yeah, not really. So this is kind of coming in the wake of the Oscars as well. So the Oscars, I should say, they just updated their rules last week. So they've basically said that performances must be carried out by real people to qualify for acting roles. Only roles, quote, demonstrably performed by humans with their consent will be considered. Golden Globes have kind of done the same thing, but in terms of how artificial intelligence is used for a film outside of performance categories, they're kind of a bit, they're a bit more loosey-goosey about it. So they said the use of artificial intelligence, including generative AI, does not automatically disqualify our work from consideration, provided that human creative direction, artistic judgment and authorship remain primary throughout the production process. All submitted work will be evaluated based on the extent to which creative direction, artistic decision-making and execution originate from credited individuals. Now, they are being as strict as the Oscars around performances. They're saying, like, performances submitted for acting categories must be primarily derived from the work of the credited performer. If a performance is substantially generated or created by using AI, they're not eligible. So last week we were talking about how Val Kilmer is starring in this film posthumously. They finished it with his permission, but like, it is generative AI. That wouldn't fly. Like, that wouldn't qualify. But it is kind of like the Golden Globes are basically being like, I think the guardrails should be a bit tighter there, because they're essentially saying, oh yeah, like if you run it through a system, that's fine, as long as it was a person running it through the system, kind of, or the person made the final call on it. I don't know, it's very...
But if it's not for performances, then it would be for special effects and that kind of thing.
Special effects, maybe. Special effects.
But how do you prove?
Writing.
Like, because you might go, give us a special effect there to create a moonscape,
yeah,
and it just does it.
Wasn't like, there an issue with The Brutalist where they were using AI to kind of finesse the sound for, was it the Hungarian language that they were using in it?
Yeah.
And they were using that to finesse, and they were like, oh, like how...
To sharpen the pronunciation of
exactly,
some of the
words. Exactly, so they were kind of judging to be like, okay. how is that kind of like fair and things like that. So maybe that's where this has stemmed from in terms of the Golden Globes.
Maybe I think that would make a lot
more
sense.
Like, that was like used, it was like people were behind it, but at the same time, AI was used. So maybe that's what's okay, but then anything else more than that is not.
Yeah.
But you're taking people's word for it, though.
Yeah.
Saying, oh, no, it was mostly me.
Yeah. It's dodgy.
Totally dodgy.
Poor Tilly Norwood, anyway. She's not going to get any Oscars or Golden Globes. R.I.P. Tilly Norwood.
Oh, I'm sure she's devastated.
Yeah. She's an AI actress for anyone's like, who they're being very crude about that woman. She's not real, so I wouldn't be crude about her.
Okay. Yeah, she's a bitch. I never liked her. So, Dean, tell us about our first beer.
Okay, so we've got Duchesse de Bourgogne Chocolate Cherry. So it's from Brewery Verhage, which is a brewery that is kind of west of Ghent and Brussels. And this, the base beer for this is a West Flanders red ale. It's quite sour.
Yeah.
I would call it a bit winky.
Yeah.
Because your face winky. Makes that kind of
Yeah,
face.
It does, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, wow. You've got quite mad. What you've got with this is it's a beer that is brewed and aged over 2 to 3 years in oak forders. So it is...
oak what, sir?
Large oak vats forders.
Oh, right, okay.
F-E-O-D-E-R-S. So they're just huge oak vats. The beer goes into that. It stays there for ages. And you have a mixed fermentation. So you have fermentation from yeast, but also fermentation from organisms that effectively live in the wood on the inside of the tank. And you get a whole pile of quite unusual flavours. The sour flavours that are coming through, lemon juice, lime juice, there's an amount of acetic. There's quite an amount of balsamic vinegar. And balsamic vinegar is a really interesting flavour. It's kind of a sweet, dark chocolate toffee and acidic flavour. I was having little spoons of balsamic vinegar last night. It can be quite syrupy, which is lovely, just to compare the flavours. But there's, I think now the acidity really lifts it up. There's chocolate in there, which comes through in the aroma. But it is a tart. And,
oh, it is, yeah. But it's like, it reminded me on first sip, like sour sweets.
Sour cold cube sweets.
Yeah.
Now there's bubblegum vanilla in there as well, and that kind of softens out the flavour as well. We were tasting it last night, and when we were tasting it, it was on the bottle, it suggests a tasting temperature of 8 to 12 degrees. These ones have come out of the fridge, so I'd say they're about 5, 6 degrees. And that really is punching through the acidity a bit more. It really is kind of sharp on the acidity.
Actually, you wouldn't want it too cold then.
No, a little bit warmer.
And
what happens with that is the chocolate comes through a little bit more.
Mm.
Now, they have the Charbic cherries, which are these expensive cherries that are used, and they are macerated into the beer. So they literally put piles of cherries into the beer, and then just over time, the cherries dissolve into the beer to give the cherry flavour in the beer. Cherries used because cherry is a surprisingly robust flavour. When you look at Belgian beers, a lot of the fruit beers are based around cherries. And what you find is that the flavour of the cherry kind of survives through the fermentation and still is present in the beer with some other fruits. You can get the fruit flavour in it, but strawberry, for example, it's a harder one to get the strawberry flavour to survive through to the beer. So, yeah, really kind of interesting beer. Between the beers that we have on the table, we have 732 years of brewing. This is a fifth generation brewery, and then a combination of two breweries.
God, you wouldn't be able to neck that one back at all.
Definitely not.
I was getting a kick of apple cider vinegar in it, and that really is a thing, but incredibly refreshing and absolutely delicious.
And what's the ABV in it?
That one is 6.8%.
Well, that's not so bad.
It's
relatively speaking,
only almost double the normal beer in Ireland.
Yes. But nothing like a normal beer in Ireland, yes. It must be said. Would you eat it? You couldn't eat any. I can't think of anything you could eat with it, except
funny enough, I was chatting to a chef. Oh, his name slips my mind. It was the chef that did the dinner for the Queen when he arrived. And his name has completely slipped my mind because I'm going senile. I presented a West Flanders Red Ale to him, and he was saying, oh, you can't pair beer with food because the bitterness tends to clash with so many foods. And I said, try this one and see what you think. He goes, oh, that's amazing. He said, that worked really well. There's a lot of foods will use acidity to balance out flavours. So like with pork and applesauce has a bit of acidity to it, a bit of sweetness and acidity. And yeah, it will do a superb job of cutting through anything that's fatty. So if you've got like kind of a pork belly type dish with lots of fat in it,
okay,
it'll cut through that and wash off the fat of the pork off your tongue. And the fruit is, if you're looking at a Christmas dinner, you've got a lot of red berries involved in the cranberry sauce with the Christmas dinner, and that works very well with stuffing and turkey. So you've got a similar thing there. But it is quite robust. Turkey might be a little bit too soft for it. You'd need something a bit more like pork or something like that to stand up to it.
I feel like some pork now. which film would you like to do first, Olivia?
Oh, we're going to go for The Sheep Detective, I think.
Sheep Detective's coming up after this.
Who's this?
His name's George Hardy. He's a shepherd.
What happened?
Probably a heart attack. Not much of a story for you, I'm afraid.
Unless there's anything out of the ordinary, right?
Nope. I've looked everywhere. Around the caravan. Underneath the caravan.
What about inside the caravan?
Worth a shot.
Oh, maybe it wouldn't do.
What?
His fingerprints, innit?
Right. Forensics.
Right, that's... But did he die naturally? That's The Sheep Detective. So it's... From that clip, I take it that chap died, the shepherd?
Yeah, so Hugh Jackman is playing a shepherd called George, and he absolutely adores all of his flock of sheep. And every night he will read to them murder mystery stories, and they are so engaged to the point that they're like, oh, I bet you it's so-and-so, I bet you it's the maid, I bet you it's this. And one...
Okay, brief interjection there. These are talking sheep.
These are talking sheep.
Yes, of course.
And they are CGI sheep with an all-star voice cast as well.
Okay.
So you'll be able to recognise some of the voices, but we'll get into that in a minute. So when George is mysteriously murdered, as we heard there, you know, the police officer originally thinks that, oh no, he's just like had a heart attack outside of his caravan in the like pissing rain kind of thing. But basically the sheep then sort of decide, you know what, we are better at solving murders than this police officer is. So we're going to help him solve the crime and figure out who murdered our beloved shepherd. And that is kind of the basis of the story. And it is as comical as you would expect it to be.
Yeah. Okay. So Hugh Jackman is the shepherd who dies at the start of the film.
He is. So he's actually really only in it for about 30 minutes. But it is just one of those characters that you can see why he signed on for the role, because the whole thing is actually just written so beautifully that you will want to be involved in it, even if it's only in like a very small way.
Yeah. And so do you see Hugh, given this is for kids, do you see Hugh Jackman like, you know, getting shivved or whatever?
See, I can't say how he dies without spoiling the end.
Yeah.
But they're very clever in how they depict it, in the fact that it's not like a gruesome death. It's not a Mortal Kombat, you know, finish him style death.
Yeah.
This is
beaten
like
to death with a mega monkey.
pretty much. This is like the sheep just sort of wake up in the morning and they find him just like lying down in the grass, looking like he could be sleeping.
Oh, gosh.
That kind of a thing. And they don't fully understand, because in sheep terms, you know, when you die, you become a cloud. And that's just what they have left.
I'm assuming the film doesn't go into actually what awaits these sheep in that they're not going to become clouds. They're going to become delicious dinners. In fact, we might be having some nice fruit beer with them one day.
Funny enough, yeah, it does actually kind of touch touch on that a little bit.
Would there not be some resentment towards Hugh Jackman about that?
Well, no, because Hugh is the shepherd that doesn't do that to his sheep. Oh. But the other shepherd, you
don't
really know.
How does he make a living?
By selling their wool. And
So
basically, when Emma Thompson's character comes into it, she's his lawyer, and she kind of reveals that, oh, he actually has £30 million in the bank.
Okay.
Which is like a motive for why he might have been murdered. But it's because he had a patent for this thing, this sheep ailment, that he ended up selling to a pharmaceutical company and made millions out of it. So that's basically how he was making his money, and then selling their wool. He never sold them for meat, but the local butcher was like dying to get his hands on the sheep for his own
evil nefarious
ways.
Yes. And so it's set in England then, is it?
It's set in the UK, yeah. Even though Hugh Jackman is still kind of doing a slightly Aussie accent, but that's just glossed over entirely.
Yeah, nobody really wants to think about that. And the way everything, do these look like real sheep or, you know?
They really do. And actually when Hugh Jackman was talking to this Irish kid, Jacob, who actually got to interview him for The Sheep Detectives, Jacob asked him, did you actually film with real sheep? And he goes, no, we filmed with puppets. And then they kind of CGI'd the sheep over that. So they do look pretty realistic. But when I say like there is an all-star voice cast, we are talking about Julia Louis-Dreyfus. We're talking about Bryan Cranston, Chris O'Dowd, Regina Hall, Patrick Stewart, Bella Ramsey, Brett Goldstein, who actually voices two Rams, and Rhys Darby as well.
Okay, so do the sheep have different accents?
Yeah, they all
some of the sheep are Americans and
Australians and all sorts. Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
They all have slightly different accents. because they're all different sheep as well. They're all from like different parts of the country that Hugh George has like collected and things like that.
And do they live on a little farm that belongs to Hugh Jackman?
They do indeed. He has like a couple of hundred acres of land, and he kind of lives like in this little caravan, as we heard in the clip there. But so it's the whole thing is like trying to figure out who the murderer is, but it's told through like accepting grief and you know trying to push boundaries and things like that. And the thing that surprised me the most is that it's actually written by Craig Mazin, who is behind Chernobyl and The Last of Us for HBO.
Yeah.
So two very adult kind of serious things. And he's after turning his hand to this like children's comedy style murder mystery thing. And it works so well. Some of the funniest jokes are the most childish. Like the thing that made me laugh the most was a play on Why Did the Chicken Cross the Road?
Mm.
Which it just had a few other like little layers to it, so it just tickled my fancy a little bit. And there's also another bit that got a great laugh when a sheep is just stuck in a tire swing.
Yeah.
And it's just coming in going meh into the clip, and you're like, yeah, that's funny.
and in terms of the grief, it's about the sheep's grief for Hugh
Jackman. Trying to comprehend what is death, what is grief. And one thing that they try and do is that when something bad happens, they try and forget. But only one of the sheep never forgets, and that's Chris O'Dowd's sheep. So he's the one that's kind of like, he has to hold on to all of the badness without letting them know, because he knows that they don't want to remember all of the bad things, whereas he's the one that's like left with that burden kind of thing. And it's just a lovely balance of when suddenly they're starting to come around and being open to, okay, sadness maybe is important, then he's like trying to like ease them into it. So it's a nice kind of dynamic that they have going on.
Okay, it sounds lovely. Will there be a second one, do you think?
I would doubt there's going to be a second one, but if there was, I'd nearly welcome it, because I think it was just such a lovely, lovely surprise. And this film has actually become Hugh Jackman's highest rated film ever.
Ha!
So like it's so highly rated in Rotten Tomatoes, it is Hugh Jackman's highest rated film. And that is saying something, like considering some of the films that he has done that have done very, very well. Yeah. So like it is just, and it's something wonderful for all the family. And it's something like, yes, it is aimed for kids, but it's something that adults can enjoy. Because like as a big like murder mystery fan, I went into this being like, I bet you it's so and so. Started watching the film, realized I had completely misinterpreted what was actually going on with some of the live action characters. And then by the end of it, they were like, hey, you were right. So I felt really vindicated, but I was still taken on the journey of still trying to figure it out as to who was the murderer. And I was still surprised that I was actually right at the end.
Well, that's good. But there's nothing worse than watching a movie with someone like you who says in the first 20 minutes, bet you it was Tom there. And you go, oh, thanks. I'll just go outside now and have a beer. Right, so... Yeah, you know the way they give kind of a free, you know, you can have a month free on a streaming service, and then people just wait, watch what they want to watch, and then cancel it. They'll have to stop doing that then, won't they?
I think a lot of them have, is the thing. So the reason why we're talking about this is that there's a new study out from, I think it was Dentsu and IGN Entertainment did it, and it's called Generations in Play 2026 Audience Insights Reports. It's basically looking at how Gen Z consume all types of media. There's stats on gaming as well. I think the study was over 6,000 engaged users, they called, from across, because I thought it was only the US, but it's actually the US, UK and Australia. And they found that more than half of Gen Z would cancel and renew a streaming subscription based on the availability of like one TV series or film. So basically like nobody, no Gen Zer is loyal to any streamer. Like they'll sign up to a Netflix to watch the last season of Stranger Things and then cancel it. Or like whenever Severance season 3 comes out, we're going to see a lot of people probably come back for that and then go, okay, bye. Which is also why I suspect, you know, HBO Max has just launched over here, and that's kind of under an umbrella of Now and others. Like, and we've talked about this, the Pitt season 2 is releasing episodically over here, even though the season is finished in America.
Yeah.
It's obviously so that people stay within a subscription model and that they don't binge it all and go, okay, bye. Like I've watched that now, as I'd imagine a lot of people would be. On the other hand, though, which I thought was interesting, 13% of Gen Z, they're more likely to attend opening weekend of a theatrical release than older moviegoers. Like they want to go the opening weekend of a film is out, which I think is good considering what we're saying.
No, that is good. I'd say probably COVID just ruined it for older.
Yeah.
But, you know, they I think so.
Also, that was interesting. There's 59% of the Gen Z surveyed said that they would watch like the latest episode of a show the day it came out because they're so scared of spoilers. But I would also counter that by saying it's because you're so online. Get off your damn phones.
Yeah.
And then you won't be spoiled.
There's that. But you'd wonder how, like when, you know, say the Stranger Things came to an end, you'd love to know what the figures were. Well, like, you know, are the likes of Netflix terrified that you know, that subscriptions drop through the floor when something like that ends and they don't have something as big as that or even nearly as big as that to replace it, well, to like, keep people there.
They're still trying to extend the IP of it, and that's what they kind of, they're trying to say from this report, the people who did it, that, you know, that it's not necessarily about like new and original content, which is frightening. It's kind of about, in order to kind of build the loyalty, you're building on existing franchises and sagas. Like they mention Stranger Things, they mention Game of Thrones, they mention The Walking Dead, like people keep coming back from what you only need to look at like House of the Dragon and that the other one that I'm forgetting, Peter Claffey. A Night of the Seven Kingdoms, which was brilliant. I will say they're bad examples because they were actually good shows. But Stranger Things, they did it's not a prequel series. I don't know what you'd call it. It's like bang smack in the middle of season 2 and season 3, and it's like an animated series. And it's the most cynical, like, cash grab attempt at, we're just going to extend this IP. The story makes, well, it makes sense, but like it doesn't make sense in terms of the canon of the Stranger Things cinematic universe. It's just, oh, this Stranger Things Tales from 85 is on. We're going to watch it because it's IP we're familiar with. There's probably a comfort thing there. You know, Gen Z are big on going back and like watching things that they've already watched because, again, we're all traumatized and we can't go outside. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's just, I expect something later on with Stranger Things that they're just going to keep, they're going to find a way to drag this out. I don't think they've fully figured it out yet, because I
hadn't read anything about it, because I know there's the final season of The Bear is coming up, and suddenly something dropped on Disney yesterday that seems to be about the dead brother.
Yes. I haven't watched it yet. Nobody's telling me anything.
I haven't watched it either.
So it's basically, it's a standalone episode. So it's Mikey, who's played by John Bernthal, and Eben Moss, Bacharach, is back as Richie, and kind of presumably telling their friendship. And as you said, what season are we at? Fifth season? This upcoming fifth season that's coming out the end of June is going to be the last season. Yeah, kind of random. I don't know if it was just to kind of build hype for this new season, to be like, hey, we're coming out in a few weeks, don't forget, here's this standalone episode to tide you over, or maybe it just didn't fit in with the context of the wider next season, I don't know.
Maybe just to remind people who may have dropped their subscription and they want them to resubscribe. This is other things, so you better get in there now.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And, wow, this Freedom McFadden has the divorce.
Yeah.
Like, it... Is the movie adaption going to come out before the book comes out almost?
This is the thing. Because I'll be honest, I haven't read a lot of Freedom McFadden stuff. Freedom McFadden did The Housemaid. Obviously, that film came out last year. It was a rip-roaring box office success. The Housemaid Secret is coming out next year with Amanda Seyfried and Sydney Sweeney, presumably, taking up their roles again. This book is only out on the 26th of this month. This new book called The Divorce. And it's already landed a movie adaptation. So there you go. That'll be out in the next few years.
She had other work.
Yes, she
adapted.
was. She has she another work adapted? That I'm not sure. I think The Housemaid was the big blockbuster one anyway. She might have had other things. I'm not really sure.
Yeah.
But this story is about Naomi. She's living the quintessential love story until her husband abruptly kicks her out and hires a divorce attorney. Naomi comes obsessed with the new girlfriend and, you know, chaos ensues, I would imagine. Yeah. So that'll be out.
Doesn't sound like a great premise so far.
Doesn't sound like a great premise, but then people would argue that The Housemaid wasn't maybe necessarily a great premise, but it got bums in seats and that's all people care about.
So. Yeah, okay. Yeah, someone gets divorced and everyone's angry.
Yeah.
Wow. It's an startlingly original concept. Right. You are listening to The Moncrief Show and News Talk. We do have to take a break. So what flavours are we dealing with here, Dean?
So what we've got now is Guinness and Timmermans Lambic and Stout. So it's a collaboration between Guinness and Timmermans, which is the oldest Lambic brewery in the world. Mm. Now, what's interesting about this, the base beer, the non-sour base beer, is a strong stout. So it's got a lot of chocolate flavour to it.
Yeah.
If you were to compare the two beers, this one is a bit more like eating a brownie with some bits of cherry and fruit in it. The other one is like having a cherry sorbet with a drizzle of chocolate over it.
Yes.
They're very, very different taste experiences. Much softer flavour, plain chocolate, cocoa. And then you have a cherry, but it also blends with red currants, raspberries, red apple flavours. Again, all a little bit softer. Now, it's a 6% beer. The Antwerp is 8%. The Porter is 6%. And the Lambic is, I believe, 5.7 or so. So when they're blended, it just comes down to 6%. You've got a lovely blend of that kind of fruit flavour, an awful lot softer foundation for the beer. The acidity is there, but it's more like an aged balsamic, softer flavour and a little bit more richness to it than the other one. The other one is a real zingy, lively, acidic beer. But Guinness has done a kind of an interesting thing. They've I've been watching it for years, going back a long time ago. Guinness for the North American market was brewed in Canada because they wanted to be able to say that it was imported in the US, so they'd bring it over the border and it was technically imported. But they have kind of embraced the idea of craft without ever saying that they're trying to be craft. So they've opened a couple of breweries in America now in two different locations. They've got Open Gate in Dublin and they're doing experimental brews and so on. And they have never, ever claimed to be craft, but they have done so many things to put themselves into a place where it would be easy to confuse them with it.
Yes, indeed. Yeah. Well, I suppose it's like it's a big multinational, so no one's going to believe them if they start claiming to be a craft brewer.
It's a very, very clever approach because some people have tried to, got at one stage, McDonald's were crafting burgers.
Yes.
Just going too far. But superb beer. It is a very quirky beer, a very limited edition. It's brewed a couple of times a year.
And the stout part, Dean, is that Guinness? Is that produced by Guinness?
It is a Guinness work. They do brew the beer and they work in collaboration with Timmermans as well. The company behind Timmermans does the distribution of Guinness in Belgium. And they are brewing Guinness Antwerpen over there under license from Guinness. So it's an 8% version of Guinness Stout. It's a variation on FES, which is the foreign export stout that you mentioned earlier on.
Right, yes.
So it's similar to in, I believe it's Nigeria, where FES is brewed for the African market. It's also brewed in Dublin, I believe. They do have some variations of it. Like they most people obviously know Guinness for Guinness. There have been they have obviously the low alcohol and the non-alcoholic version of Guinness now, so they have kind of done some things outside of it, but with FES they've had a couple of line extensions that are there. But very, very quirky beer and expensive, but a taste experience.
And in both cases the bottles are almost black from where I'm sitting.
It's brown bottles in both cases. The beer in the first beer, the Duchess de Bourgogne cherry chocolate, is a kind of a deep red ruby colour. And when you combine that with the brown, it makes it darker.
Yeah.
With this, the liquid in the bottle is black, so it's going to make it look black.
But if I noticed there's a cork in it, and you know, a little thing around the cork, as you'd have in champagne. So is it pressurised?
Well, what you've got with it, and this happened to somebody in the UK where they blended beer with, I believe it was a saison. Now, the microorganisms that are responsible for the spontaneous fermentation in the lambic, the spontaneous fermentation with lambic is where they let microorganisms from the air settle into liquid and a fermentation happens over a 3 to 6 month period. But they're wild organisms. It's not a controlled culture. And they can be incredibly aggressive. So what happened with this brewery in the UK was they got a beer with organisms like this and blended it with another beer and packaged it immediately. And they had completely fermented out the beer that they were blending it with. So all that was left was unfermentable sugars. But they were unfermentable to the yeast that had been used to brew that beer. They were completely fermentable to the wild yeast in the saison. So what happened was that the thing just underwent a massive secondary fermentation. It went in, it was on supermarket shelves, and it was popping left, right and center. Now they've been clever with this. They've made sure that happens in the brewery
and not in the
supermarket shelves.
So Paul Mescal, Jesse Buckley back together for is it another love story?
They're obsessed with each other. Yeah, they're obsessed with being in love stories.
Or like producers are just trying to make them out as kind of a bit coupley.
Maybe. I don't know. This is called Hold On to Our Angels. It's from Ben Zetlin, who did Beasts of the Southern Wild. He's writing and directing, set on the edge of South Louisiana, and Mescal will play a, quote, hellbound outlaw, and Buckley will play a ferocious shepherd of lost souls. They obviously fall in catastrophic love and, you know, all hell breaks loose.
Okay.
They're shooting in February. So,
okay.
So if you're into that.
This sounds more like an action-y thing rather than...
Kind of. I'm getting big Yellowstone vibes off it. Well,
yeah,
certainly not as like period drama.
Yeah.
My wife is a witch and, you know, et cetera, et cetera. But look, we'll see.
We'll see.
You're into it.
Well,
you're into
it. The two of them are in it. So there you go. Anyway, our second movie is Mortal Kombat 2. Here's a clip.
Listen, I'm warning you. I got a Saturn Award for best fight in a feature film, so don't mess with me.
Whoa, easy, all right? Let's just take a time out here and talk about it, okay? I really don't feel comfortable hitting a girl.
Don't worry, you won't.
Okay, so that's probably the longest period of dialogue there is in this film, is it?
Actually, yeah, probably one of the longest ones. Yes, as you heard there, that is Carl Urban doing an American accent, I swear. He is playing Johnny Cage, who is one of the most popular characters in the Mortal Kombat universe. In this this storyline, Johnny Cage is a... I don't want to say retired actor, but he was like really well known in the 80s, and now he's kind of like not really getting many signatures when he goes to Comic Cons and things like that. So he gets tagged in by the Champions of Earthrealm to basically fight in the Mortal Kombat in order to save Earth from the big baddie, who is Shao Kahn, I want to say. I may have that wrong.
Shaka Khan is going to invade the world. Well, that's the most terrifying thing I can think of.
Yes, definitely. So basically, it's just that you've got two teams and they're fighting for the sake of Earth, essentially, from all these different universes. It is a fighting game, Mortal Kombat. You know, the first one, as I said earlier, didn't really have a lot of the Mortal Kombat in it, whereas this film is literally literally encompassed in the whole premise of a Mortal Kombat, which is you lose, you probably die.
Yeah.
So there's characters that you're going to get introduced to that do not make it to the end, and then there's characters that you're introduced to that do make it to the end. I'm not going to tell you which ones.
Oh, no spoilers, please.
Some of the positives from this is that the fight choreography, which is like the main kind of draw for a lot of people, on point, very, very good. Some bits that have clearly used like wires or CGI in some of the sequences does detract from it a little bit, but I can see why they did it. It's very like akin to the games and the fighting style of that. Even some of the cinematography is done very much in line with how the video game works. So it's like that side-on view of some of the locations, things like that. Downside is there's really not much of a plot outside of everyone's just going to go fighting. But again, if you're going to see a Mortal Kombat movie, you probably don't really care that there's not much more of a plot.
But I say, is Carl Urban's character, because in that clip says, I got a Saturn Award for best fight sequence. So is he an ex-actor or something?
So he's a former actor who basically, the gods have determined that he is also very special and can... clearly has like special powers, but he's like, oh, I don't know what you're talking about.
I'm just Tom Cruise, basically.
Yeah.
So he's acting at fighting before, but now this is really fighting.
Yes, and there's actually like a great kind of sequence where it's a clip from one of his like really 80s movies where he's like putting on the shades and he's battling all the bad guys. And he clearly used to be like a martial artist who has now kind of like gone out of favor with Hollywood. Mm. And he's a bit of like a washed up movie star. That's the turn of phrase I was searching for earlier. Yeah. But apparently everyone still thinks that he's like this major, you know, martial artist and that can, you know, help save the earth from this demon god coming in.
But like the gods decide he's got these powers, or who asks him to get
involved?
Yeah,
so it turns out like deep within him, he may have some kind of superpower, shall we say.
Yeah.
And all of the other people that are involved from Earthrealm who are fighting for the earth's survival, they have all like tapped into what their power is, whereas he's just like, I've just been tagged in. This is happening tomorrow. How the hell am I supposed to figure out if I have one of these or not?
Right. And Earthrealm, is that just Earth?
Earth, yeah.
Yeah, okay. Like, is there another realm?
Yeah, so the main realm, I couldn't tell you what the name of the other realm is.
Okay, other realm is possibly what it's called.
Yes, the Mortal Kombat realm.
Yeah, sounds gripping. And it's probably the second of a series of 92 films.
It's the second film. You don't need to have seen the first one in order to enjoy this. Aside from a couple of like other like continuity issues, it's fine. It's a Mortal Kombat movie with actual Mortal Kombat in it. If you're going just for a bit of like action, kickboxing, whatever, you know, you're going to enjoy it. But otherwise, if you're looking for something with a little bit more depth, then go for The Sheep Detectives.
Yeah. Finally,
what a crazy sentence.
Yeah, I know, right?
I know. But a fun one to say, I must say. Finally, Hocus Pocus 3 in the works.
Yes!
Yeah.
Yes. I kept the remake story to the last. They're coming back. Even though the second one was not that good, but it doesn't matter because people know they will go and see those three crazy witches. Second one obviously came out in 2022, broke all kinds of streaming records. But they're thinking they might do, it's still in early development, but they're thinking they might do a theatrical release for this one because, again, obviously you have such name brand recognition. Yeah. All the girls are back, Sarah Jessica Parker, Bette Midler, Kathy Najimy. Can we not though? Can we actually just not? Can we try and make anything else?
Can we try and make dogs lie?
Actually, yeah. One of these weeks, listeners, we'll talk about an actual original film concept. No doubt. We'll all look forward to that. Thanks to Dean McGuinness, Fionnuala Jones and Olivia Fahey.
Movies and Booze on Moncrief.
Of all the gin joints in all the world, she walks into mine.
A martini, shaken, not stirred.
I ate his liver with some fava beans and a nice Chianti.